This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call the show Main Street because our microphones create a Main Street all across the state this time of day. The real Main Streets that are centerpieces of our communities are places where we meet and greet each other, you know, talk about what's on our minds and share our news and opinions, maybe dart across the street to the corner cafe, have a roll and a cup of coffee. Well, food is foundational to our lives. It's necessary for survival. But it also serves a social purpose. We have dinner parties, brunches, potlucks, bake sales, holiday feasts. We like to gather around food. So why don't we always pay more attention to where our food comes from and how we're using it? The Cass Clay Food Partners and Ugly Food of the North are two organizations working to create healthier, more sustainable food systems. Today, they launched a speaker series to connect food producers and consumers in order to increase community involvement. The first presenters were from Growing Together, a community garden ministry. It started in 2006 with just 9 families and now serves 150 families. Founder Jack Wood shares how it works.
In 2017, our gardens produced 57,000 pounds of food on 93,000 square feet. In comparison, corn in that same space would have produced 18,000 pounds. The corn production would be 20% of our vegetable production. So the biggest expense to a community garden is the plants. A 6-pack of tomatoes will be like $2.99. So part of the reason that we've been able to keep our costs low is we start all of our seeds indoors. I start them in my basement, and then we take them out. We do like a greenhouse planting at the end of April. We start planting them into our gardens in late May. So in 2018, we will start over 10,000 seedlings. When we plant our gardens, all the gardeners are there helping us plant. The key is definitely a lot of supervision to make sure that we don't overplant certain things. We had one year that somebody grabbed the bag of spaghetti squash, which a normal buttercup will have 2 fruits per vine. Spaghetti squash is like 15. We had truckloads of squash. So the other thing that we are doing is everything is planted in a raised bed. And what we have done is there's a gentleman in Canada, his name is Jean-Martin Fortier. He's a Frenchman. And off of his acre and a half, he produces over $150,000 worth of food. So we have been working on implementing this. And in the beginning, to raise the beds, it is a lot of work, but it definitely has paid off. Part of our key to success, when we first started our garden, we would garden on a Thursday, and then everybody would be there on Saturday, and we'd probably be there on Tuesdays. But through our evolution, we have found that we are able to garden each of our gardens 3 hours a week by knowing what to water, what to take care of. There are certain things that say maybe like okra that grows really fast that maybe we have to stop, but we've been able to figure out to gather the community together to garden that one day a week. Every gardener that works with us becomes a shareholder once they have worked 16 hours. After you work 16 hours, every single person in the garden can have a share. And what we will normally do is say, like at our South Garden, 6:30, we will count the people. If we have like 60 people, we will provide 60 share boxes. At the end of the evening, each person gets a share. Thank you very much.
That was Jack Wood from Growing Together, a community garden ministry. The group raises money selling plants in the spring and produce in the fall. Fargo Mayor Tim Mahoney declared today Jack Wood Day in Fargo to honor his service. Simeon Bakunda is one of the gardeners. He came from a refugee camp in Zambia 8 years ago. He wasn't always able to find his traditional foods in our grocery stores, but had better luck at Asian markets.
I went to one of those grocery stores. I found some eggplant. I took them home and dried them out. So it was kind of curious for me. I would like to know whether they will grow here. My first job didn't last for long. But when I found my second one, I had the opportunity to talk to my boss. And I asked him whether he could help me to find a small piece of land in a friend's backyard to grow my own veggies. He told me he would instead connect me with someone who turned out to be Jack Wood. That's how I got to know him. I officially joined his group in 2011. In 2015, he acquired a new garden, but it was very hard for him to manage the garden, and he came to me and asked me whether I could help and be part of the leadership team. I accepted the offer, but I was about to lose my friendship with the gardeners I had just made at the gathering. But I even came to know much more people, and I will tell you that being part of the garden, the community garden, has provided me not only food, but also it gave me the opportunity to connect and socialize with people. Through them, I have come to learn much more about living here. And my dream is to someday own my own small garden. I thank you.
That was Simeon Bakunda talking about his experiences with Growing Together, a community garden ministry. Nola Storm is a longtime garden enthusiast who is also active with the ministry. She spoke about how gardening together grows more than food.
And the who I've decided to talk about, I'm going to call her Jeannie. She's a young mom, single mom, that came here to the United States from Rwanda. If you, any of you know anything about the situation that happened in Rwanda several years ago, it was pretty horrific. There was ethnic division that created an impossible situation for her family to stay. And she came here with her young son, and she was pregnant, and she couldn't bring her the father of her children because they didn't have an official marriage certificate. So she came here with basically no English, and she joined our first garden. By that time, her second child was born, and so, you know, she wore him on her back when she was gardening. And, you know, our very first year and a couple of years, we only had about 8 families. So we had an individual plot for each one of the families, and she spoke so little English, and we, in our great wisdom, thought we should know what everybody wants in their garden. So we just determined what would be planted in the individual plots, and then we just shared the work and the produce from the greater area. And so in Jeannie's garden, we planted cucumbers because, like, quite frankly, who doesn't, like, love cucumbers? Well, she didn't. Well, we didn't know, and she was really shy, and she didn't have a lot of English, so we, you know, made this faux pas. Anyway, we've learned a lot, and it's helped us to have folks to say, you know, we really don't want that, and that's not typical in our diet. As time progressed, Jeannie developed, you know, her English improved dramatically, and she stopped being shy. She had this marvelous, delightful, funny, fun personality, and she became super connected with some of the other ladies from West Africa, and their playfulness was just so much fun to watch. Well, she got a better job, and she got her driver's license, and eventually she became an American citizen, which meant that she was also able to go back, get officially married, and then bring her husband now back here to the United States. Well, time goes on when you're a busy family, and she stopped being able to be a regular gardener with us. But periodically, she would show up. And, oh, by the way, she also learned to really like cucumbers, which was pretty awesome. But she would show up, and, you know, she would come, and we'd always, like, force her, you know, come on, take some vegetables home, and, you know, because that's just kind of nice to be able to say we have enough. And one time she came, and always wanted to, like, give her a little dig about how we introduced her to cucumbers. You know, I'm, you know, saying, Jeannie, you need to take some vegetables with you, and especially take all the cucumbers you want. And she kept saying, no, I really don't want any. And it was kind of confusing to me why she wouldn't want any. And she's getting in her car, and I'm kind of doggedly pursuing her. And she said, Nola, I didn't come here for the vegetables. I came here because you're my friends. So that tells you the why.
Nola Storm with Growing Together, a community garden ministry. Storm, Bakunda, and Wood spoke this morning at an event for the Cass Clay Food Partners and Ugly Food of the North, which was live-streamed on Facebook. The speakers series will take place on the first Friday of the month from 7:30 to 9 a.m. at Moorhead's Theater B. And you can follow Ugly Food of the North on Facebook for its schedule of live streams. Coming up on Main Street, we'll hear about the extended exhibit of the illuminated St. John's Bible at the Heritage Imcomb Center.
Programming is supported by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative. Touchstone Energy Cooperatives comprise a nationwide network of more than 749 Touchstone Cooperative consumer-owned utilities dedicated to innovation, integrity, and commitment to community.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Direct Travel Satrum Tours, offering a Baltic cruise and Orion cruise in June 2018. Also offering two comprehensive Alaska land and sea tours in July and August 2018. More information at 1-800-833-8787 or satrumtravel.com.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. This evening's Prairie Pulse television show will feature an interview with Maureen Kelly Jonasson, Executive Director of the Heritage Imcomb Center in Moorhead. Guest host Barb Gravel talked with Jonasson about the success of the illuminated St. John's Bible exhibit, which was supposed to close at the end of the year, but has been extended into February due to its popularity.
Maureen, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Over the years, I've attended and you've had so many amazing exhibits. Now, recently, you've had the fabulous St. John's Bible exhibit, right?
Yes.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
This was truly an organizational changing exhibition for us, and we kind of knew that it had that potential 4 years ago when we made the decision to go forward with it. It was a bit of a nail biter because it was a huge investment and it was a risk to take. We had already had an exhibit of The Prince, which was a very inexpensive exhibition of reproductions, and it was so popular I couldn't believe it. I was poo-pooing it and thinking, oh, who wants to come and see a Bible? But it was so popular that we then, after the Bible was finished, we went for the seven reproduction volumes, and that was hugely popular also. So as soon as that closed, volunteer Ann Casey and I put our heads together and said, let's bring original pages. So, and it turns out that it's almost the largest exhibition of these pages that have ever been shown. So, while you can get one or two pages at a time, we decided to go for, 68 pages. This is the first handwritten Bible commissioned by a Benedictine monastery in 500 years. So while lots of things have been hand calligraphied and illuminations have been painted and such, this is the first time the entire Bible, every word of it, over 1,100 pages, has been put to vellum in the old-fashioned medieval way, and these beautiful original paintings have illuminated it throughout the entire Bible. So it's truly a work of the ages. They expect it to last well over 2,000 years, it was made right here, commissioned by St. John's in Minnesota, so it's a Minnesota Bible, and we decided it was just a natural combination of history and art, and the wonderful conversation you can have when those two things intersect.
Do you know how many visitors you had see the exhibit, and was it maybe your most popular exhibit?
Well, we had a modest goal originally. I budgeted a modest goal of 5,000. The last quarter of the year is typically about 3,000 people total for October, November, December. Later on, we decided to think really big, and so we went for 10,000. Now, what happened was in October, the first month, we had over 3,000 visitors in just the first month. So in essence, we ended up with twice as many visitors as we would have had in that time, almost 10,000 visitors, and we were thrilled. In addition, we beat all of our admission goals, our gift shop goals, and also we just had a 25% increase in membership to the society as a result. So I can't say enough about what a wonderful contribution it's made to our community.
Wow, that's a great Christmas gift.
Oh,
great.
Absolutely. Happy New Year.
Wonderful. Can you tell us about the docents? I know they were invaluable to this project, to this exhibit.
Absolutely. I can't say enough about Ann Casey, who really was a volunteer who put in full-time labor into this project, because it is a labor of love for her. And she actually recruited and trained over 45 people to be docents. Docents are trained tour guides who actually provide interpretation to an exhibit. And really, they enhance the visit. So it's not just passive. You don't just go in and look. They provide the background, and they gave some interpretation. What they basically said is, here are some interesting things to look for as you go through, because there are some consistent threads going on throughout the entire exhibition, and you want to watch for rainbows. You want to watch for the fish. And these have significance, and you want to keep your eyes open for it. So every single visitor could decide, I want some, I want none, I want a ton of help in experiencing this exhibit. And the docents really just very limberly adapted to whatever the visitor wanted.
Can you tell us a little bit about what's coming up in the year 2018?
2018, we've got some wonderful, wonderful things. We've got our three festivals, of course. Some people think we're the Celtic Festival, but we're not. The City of Moorhead and Fargo, the park departments do that. And they put on Celtic Festival in March. But then in June, we partner with Nordic Culture Clubs. They do the Scandinavian Yumcoms Festival inside, and we take care of the Midwest Viking Festival outside. Mm-hmm. So it is a 50-50 partnership, and it's been working really well for the last 4 years. This will be our fifth year. In September, we've been doing a German Culture Fest, mid-September, that's gaining in popularity. And then very popular in November is our Pangea Festival. Pangea Cultivate Our Cultures. This year we had 1,750 people, so we were very excited about that.
Wow, congratulations. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Other programming includes exhibits. We change exhibits anywhere from 6 to 8 times a year, and I know people forget that. They say they've seen the ship, they've seen the Hopperstadstav Church. Why should they go back? Well, it's because we've got a lot of exhibits. So this year, we'll be bringing in a great exhibit called We Are Water, which is all about how Minnesota is a lot about water, but people in general have to have water to live and how we use water. We'll be bringing in a fabulous exhibit at the end of the year called Beyond Bollywood, How Indian Americans Shape the Nation. So it's looking at how people originally from India have come to our country and made a significant contribution to its development. And we have a large Indian, Asian Indian community here in Fargo-Moorhead. So they're very excited to be partnering with us, and we'll be bringing all kinds of interesting programming for that exhibition. The biggie is our World War I exhibition. In March, we will open a brand new local history exhibition focused on war, flu, and fear is what it's called. World War I in Clay County. So that's been researched and written over the last 2 years and will be installed in starting in January.
Well, thank you so much for visiting with me, Maureen. It's been wonderful having you.
Thank you.
Barb Gravel talking with Maureen Kelly-Jonason, Executive Director of the Yumcombe Center in Moorhead. You can watch the entire Prairie Pulse show this evening at 7:30 Central on the television service of Prairie Public. Coming up on Main Street, Natural North Dakota.
Coming soon, the winners of the 2017 Third Coast Competition, the best audio documentaries of the year.
Can you see me? Blink once for yes.
I go at night so that I can't be seen.
Police are seen.
The dash cam video reveals the sequence of events during this critical minute.
Stand by for police.
Listen for Best of the Best from the Third Coast Festival here on your public radio station.
Best of the Best 2017, this week's Prairie Public Presents, coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Even in the dead of winter, there's wildlife all around us. It may be under shelter, but it's there. Chuck Lura is a biologist, and he teaches that subject at Dakota College at Botineau. He also teaches us a bit about the animal and plant life around us with his Natural North Dakota essays. Today, his subject is a bird called a merlin.
I recently saw a falcon-like bird. The sky was overcast with poor lighting, so I was unable to get any good markings, but I suspect it may have been a merlin. The merlin is a falcon. Their scientific name is Falco columbarius. Falcons, or the genus Falco, is derived from the Latin term falx, or sickle, which is reportedly a reference to the sickle shape of the wings when the bird's in flight. The epithet columbarius is a reference to pigeons. That's because merlins in flight resemble pigeons. Many among us probably even learned this species as pigeon hawks. Calling this species a pigeon hawk may lead some people to assume pigeons are the main prey item, but they aren't. Merlins typically prey on much smaller birds, such as horned larks, house sparrows, and smaller shorebirds, and other birds of similar size. Merlins are a bit larger and heavier than the more commonly observed kestrel or sparrowhawk. They're often described as dark and streaky falcons. Falcons, of course, are known for their speed and maneuverability. They have long tapered wings, and the tail tapers towards the tip. Male merlins are grayish, while the females are brown, with both sexes having a heavily streaked breast and white bands on their tails. One other helpful characteristic is that merlins generally lack the mustache stripe that's so characteristic of falcons. Merlins generally nest further north. However, North Dakota lies within their historical breeding range, and a few may still nest in the state. However, they winter in the south and west United States and Central America, so they're probably most often observed during the spring and fall migrations, even though a few sightings occur throughout the year. Unlike most raptors we're familiar with that swoop down on their prey, from soaring high above or perhaps a perch, merlins use a rather unusual method of hunting. They'll fly swiftly and low above the ground, flushing small birds from their perch. Once the small birds have flushed, the chase is on. If all goes well for the merlin, they'll catch their prey in midair. Some merlins are even known to hunt in pairs. One flushes the flock of birds, and during all the confusion, the other swiftly goes in for the prey. So as you travel about, be on the lookout for this interesting falcon. And if you should be fortunate enough to see one, it might be worth taking a few minutes to just get a better look at it. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Botineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, a discussion of the week's big stories with news director Dave Thompson. And Matt Olin reviews two new movies.
This week on Away With Words, some schoolyard slang from Chicago.
Well, I grew up on the north side of Chicago, and when someone came with a new haircut, we would stand around him and point fingers and say, baldy sour, baldy sour.
Join us.
My son, who is almost 15, looked at me like I was crazy and said, Mom, that's not even a word.
Saturday morning at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
The secret to love, it's in this equation.
W at T plus 1 equals little w plus IHM brackets HT.
That's so romantic.
Oh, yeah. I struggle to find anything you can't get an interesting perspective on by using math.
I'm Guy Raz. How numbers rule the world. Next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday at noon, 11 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. In the background, and a vintage wire machine reminding Dave Thompson and me about days gone by.
Exactly.
When we were in newsrooms where that was the background sound all the time.
Right. And Doug, did I ever tell you about the first commercial newsroom I worked in out of college?
No.
The newsroom was in the transmitter room.
Oh, great.
And the wire machine was there.
So it was always warm.
So it was always warm, but it was always, always noisy.
All right. Do you glow in the dark still? Or
A little bit.
All right. Well, let's talk about the news. You had a headline a couple of hours ago today at the third quarter 2017 sales and purchases in the state have ticked upward.
Ticked up and went up about 2.5%. And what's driving it is the increased activity in the Bakken.
Mm-hmm.
The oil drilling is up. Production has remained above 1 million barrels a day. It all adds up. And there are help wanted signs in Williston right now that I know of, help wanted signs in Waterford City, help wanted signs in Tioga. They're hiring again. They're looking for frac crews. This all adds up to, you know, more activity out there. But the further east you go from basically the central part of the state to the eastern part of the state, it's a little down, but not bad, maybe 3 or 4%.
All right. Well, we see nationwide that unemployment is around 4.1%, which is basically fully employed in this country.
That's right.
So maybe it's going to be a little tougher to find those people in western North Dakota. Maybe those wages will be a little higher.
It could very well be that way. And you know, they were having trouble filling frac crews to start working on the wells that have been sitting idle and had not been fracked yet. But at last report, they have 24 frac crews and they were looking for 26.
All right. Well, the price of oil is approaching $62 today a barrel. So.
Right. And you've seen some of the reports that we could see a major spike in gasoline prices in January and February.
Well, that usually says that oil prices are going up.
That's right.
Okay. Well, another story you just filed today, North Dakota's congressional delegation is talking about infrastructure. Well, it's about time everybody else is.
Right. But what I found interesting, and I did not know this until talking to the members of our congressional delegation, is that the $1 trillion that's being proposed by the administration would be $200 billion of federal spending, but $800 billion from other sources, perhaps public-private partnerships, and maybe some from local and state governments. So there's a lot more to talk about when they get to the nuts and bolts of that bill.
Yeah. And, of course, we've got major infrastructure projects pending in North Dakota, some of them having to do with water.
That's correct, especially in Fargo and in Minot, because both flood control projects have a public-private partnership built into them.
Well, this is something that has nationwide approval. Everybody likes the idea of roads that are better and railroads that work, you know, that kind of thing. So,
and we do have an aging infrastructure in many cases. I was looking at some statistics there about how many bridges across the country are in need of repair or need of replacement, and North Dakota has a share of that, too.
Well, everybody in our listening audience is in an area that probably has a bridge or a road that needs some fixing up.
Exactly.
Well, let's talk about redesigning social service delivery in North Dakota. You filed that story yesterday.
I found it interesting when they were talking about tearing a city down and rebuilding the city. That's what they're talking about. It is more complicated than I even thought it was when I started covering this. And it's going to take a little while to get this whole thing together. What they're looking for is a way to kind of streamline the delivery to people who need it. And in this whole thing about children who are born, you know, with some developmental disabilities, there's a lot of bureaucracy in there. And they're trying to kind of clear that out a little bit so that you're only dealing with one or two people, not four or five.
And there's a new head of social service in North Dakota, isn't there?
Right, Chris Jones. He's a very dynamic guy. He is the one who is spearheading this idea. He wants to see delivery improved. And, of course, he's got the blessing of Governor Burgum, who wants to reinvent government.
Okay. So keep tuned on this
one. Oh, yes. Huh? This is going to be interesting.
The North Dakota Extension Service says soybean acres could expand in the state. I suspect that means less corn then or something.
That's what
like
they're
that.
Thinking. That even though they said soybean acres are going to expand, and for the past 2 years, soybean has actually topped hard red spring wheat as the top crop in North Dakota. But corn is a little bit problematic. Prices are down.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make, at least at this point, sense for farmers to plant it except in the western part of North Dakota where the costs are a little bit down to do it. But it's riskier to do it.
Well, when I think about soybeans, I also think about international trade. And,
right.
That's a commodity that is shipped to Japan and China, I think. And
that is correct, yes.
So fussing with those arrangements might make some of those farmers a little nervous.
I know there's some concern in the agriculture community, not only about the Trans-Pacific Partnership that was canceled, but also the NAFTA renegotiations and trade policy. There's some concern among farmers. And in talking to Dr. Ernie Goss, who from Creighton University, who does the Mid-American Business Conditions Index, he talked about how North Dakota is really dependent on NAFTA trade.
Mm-hmm.
So the agriculture community, no matter what, you're watching that one very carefully.
Well, Canada and Mexico are like one and two in terms of who we trade with.
Exactly. And I think it is one and two.
Okay. Well, here's a story that Danielle Webster filed earlier this week. A new law protects consumers from massive air ambulance bills. Good.
Yes. And I did not realize that in some cases, you know, air ambulance is the only way you can get from, you know, a wilderness area, a rural area in North Dakota to a hospital. But when the bill comes back, some of these people were seeing thousands of dollars in bills, and now the legislature did wrestle with this and did pass a bill, and it has taken effect, that you have to know up front what the costs are going to be. And there are penalties if the insurance department deems that you're charging way too much.
Wow, but they're talking about some bills totaling between $20,000 and $60,000. Imagine if you're told that. I mean, can I get in a – is there some other way? I mean, that is a – that's an impossible decision.
It is an impossible decision. You need the care right now, and the worry is $60,000?
Wow.
You're going to come up with $60,000.
That is really scary. It makes you wonder about, you know, maybe some way to subsidize it or some other way to deal with this.
Yeah, I know there's still some study on that legislatively.
Okay. Well, Bismarck Republican State Representative Rick Becker says he's not going to run for higher office. Huh?
Right, and he was considering either the Senate or the House. And he went to Washington, D.C., met with Club for Growth and some of these other organizations. And he came away saying, you know, that there's a lot more work to do in North Dakota, so he's going to run for re-election to his seat. There has been talk that there may be a primary challenge or a challenge at the convention, so that's one worth watching.
Oh, okay, that would be interesting. Of course, Kevin Cramer is about to decide, isn't he, about whether he's going to run for Heidi Heitkamp's Senate seat?
That's right, and he's been wined and dined by the powers that be in Washington to take the leap of faith and go for the Senate. I know there's some reluctance there because he's really settling in more of a leadership role in the House. But he said by the end of January he will have a decision because he wants a decision this time before the state convention, which is going to be held in early April.
Well, as he has pointed out, there's only one representative for North Dakota. There are two senators.
That's correct, yes.
Okay, how about Tom Campbell, though? He's vying for that.
Tom Campbell has said that, yeah, he's going to run for the U.S. Senate. But if Kevin Cramer steps in that race, he will run for the House seat.
Okay.
So he's very interested in higher office as well.
So Heidi Heitkamp might have an interesting race on her hands.
She might. In terms of the money, I have been talking to some people about what kind of money we might see in the Senate race. And I have heard this figure, and I'm going to pass it along because it came to me from representatives of both sides, representatives Democrats and Republicans. They're predicting it could be a $30 million race this year.
Good
in
heavens.
North Dakota.
That would be about
would be
50
amazing.
Bucks a head for everybody in the state, including those who can't vote.
That's right.
Wow. That's a lot of money. Okay. Voting machines could pose a challenge for counties. Apparently, they're getting older, Dave.
Right. Well, these were bought in 2004 through the Help America Vote Act. Secretary of State Jaeger has asked the legislature in the past session to upgrade things. The legislature couldn't fund it. So now what they're doing is cannibalizing machines so that they have a couple working machines. But I had to laugh in talking to Jim Silrum, the Deputy Secretary of State. He said these machines are all based on Windows 7.
Wow.
And Windows 7 is too slow. I thought that was interesting.
Well,
I still use Windows 7 at home.
Well, we use Windows 10 here. So that is a few systems back there.
It is.
All right. So will we be looking at new machines?
Probably they're going to try in the 19 session, but for 18, no, it's going to be a little touch and go, I think.
Okay. Well, 18 is shaping up as a fascinating election year.
I think it's going to be really fascinating myself.
Okay. Well, we check in with our news director, Dave Thompson, every Friday. Thanks for chatting with us, Dave.
You're very welcome, sir.
And have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
A new book asks if the high priest of psychedelic drugs, Timothy Leary, was really the most dangerous man in America, as President Nixon claimed.
We need to find a villain, a guy in a black hat, and why not choose Timothy Leary?
I'm Ari Shapiro. That story, and you're not tripping, Robert Siegel turns off his microphone for the last time this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered comes up next here on Prairie Public.
There's the fanfare. It's time to talk about the movies with Matt Olean. That's Prairie Public's resident film critic. And you went to a couple of movies because it's the busy season.
Very busy for me because this is Oscar bait season. So a lot of films are slowly working their way into Minnesota and North Dakota and Winnipeg. What happens, Doug, is during award season, they have to be released in Los Angeles and New York for at least 2 weeks to be Oscar eligible. But films like The Post and Phantom Thread are not here yet. I, Tonya, not here yet. But I did see a couple films that have Oscars in their eyes, The Disaster Artist and All the Money in the World. Let's start with The Disaster Artist, currently playing at various venues, including the Fargo Theater. This is James Franco starring and directing in the film about the making of The Room. The Room is a 2003 film directed, produced, written, and starring Tommy Wiseau, who has now become a cult figure on sort of the midnight movie circuit because The Room is so bad. It's called the Citizen Kane of bad movies, and it is awful, Doug. I have seen it. And the film is thrown wildly off kilter by Wiseau's acting. He is from somewhere in Eastern Europe. His origins are murky. He's been very mysterious about his origins, where he got his money to make films, where he's from, how old he is, and James Franco plays him expertly. And I must say, Doug, this is a much better film than The Room. So it's about the making of The Room based on the book by Greg Sestero, who worked with Wiseau on The Room, and it's his take on what happened.
It just seems like such an audacious idea, mm-hmm. though, to take a famously bad movie and make a movie about it.
Well, Ed Wood did that as well. Tim Burton's Ed Wood with Johnny Depp as Ed Wood did the same thing. Franco gives maybe the performance of the year, Doug. I on our September preview show for the fall, I did predict he would get a Best Actor nomination. It was based on gut instinct. It was based on some buzz. And he got a SAG nomination, so I think he's going to be Oscar nominated. He commits fully to the performance as Wiseau, complete with the bizarre accent and his weird idiosyncrasies that he has. And it's a phenomenal performance. People who have not seen The Room may get tired of kind of the one joke thing about the film, which is how awful Wiseau is as an actor, how he mistreats people on the set. He doesn't really know what he's doing. He shoots the film in film and in digital both. He doesn't really understand that you really don't mix the two. There's lots of hilarious scenes recreating the awful scenes from The Room, but Franco gives a phenomenal performance, and he completely commits to it. He thinks he's kind of this James Dean, Marlon Brando method actor, and there's some very funny scenes where he's at acting class trying to do a scene from Streetcar Named Desire. And the film isn't too long. It's only about an hour 45, and I like this one a lot. It's funny. It's got that right it has that fine line, Doug, between comedy and not going too far.
That's what I was
going to
ask
parody.
You because it seems like you could be making fun of Tommy Wiseau and you know miss some of the poignancy of being a Tommy Wiseau.
Yeah, he does make fun of him to a degree because it's based on Greg Sestero's experiences on the film, but you also sort of end up like liking him or sort of feeling for his naivete that he doesn't realize he's a lousy actor. He doesn't realize he's not making a masterpiece. It becomes unintentionally funny to audiences, but now he's completely in on the joke. As the years have gone on, he tours with the film. Greg Sestero tours with the film.
He's done interviews with Franco, I think.
Yes. I mean, he may be Franco's guest at the Oscars. Wouldn't that be hilarious? But yeah. I don't think it's a mocking film. I think it's a film about people who have a dream and commit to the dream even though they don't realize they're not talented enough to achieve that dream. There's a one scene in the film where he delivers Hamlet's soliloquy to a movie producer in a restaurant while he's eating.
Oh,
and the producer gets upset and he says, look, acting's a one-in-a-million shot, even if you have Brando's talent. And he tells Tommy Wiseau that, and he says, it'll never happen for you in a million years. Even after a million years, it won't happen for you. So I did like this film a lot. I think it's one of my favorite films of the year. You don't have to see The Room to appreciate the film. I don't think you do. Stay tuned for the closing credits. They do have side-by-side scenes of Franco doing the same scenes as Tommy Wiseau did in The Room, and it is spot on.
All right. Well, let's talk about the other movie, All the Money in the World. Some of us are old enough to remember this story pretty vividly. And the grandpa that might have been one of the meanest guys in the world.
J. Paul Getty was not only the richest man in the world in 1973, Doug, he was the richest man in the history of the world. And his grandson, J. Paul Getty III, is kidnapped in Rome. We all remember, those of us old enough remember this kidnapping. It was a big deal. He was kidnapped. There was a ransom.
He had his ear cut off.
He had his ear cut off. We're not giving anything away. That happens in the film as well. Christopher Plummer replaced Kevin Spacey as J. Paul Getty. And that is really what this film is best known for now, is the whole Kevin Spacey backlash. Plummer came in, shot the retakes in 2 to 3 weeks, and Plummer is phenomenal. He knocks it out of the park, Doug. Now you can't even imagine Spacey having old age makeup playing J. Paul Getty when Plummer is about the right age. But Plummer's such a professional, Doug. He's obviously came in here, did a great performance. Michelle Williams is actually very, very good as his ex-daughter-in-law, who was married to J. Paul Getty Jr. She kind of goes on the offensive to get her son back. But, of course, J. Paul Getty doesn't want to pay the ransom. An ex-CIA guy played by Mark Wahlberg is brought in. This is Ridley Scott kind of getting back to territory, what he's best at, kind of thrillers like Black Hawk Down. But the film is too long, Doug. It goes on an interminable amount of time, about 20 to 25 minutes too long. There's some scenes that are repetitious after a while. Overall, I liked it. I do like thrillers like this, but I don't think it's quite Oscar material, although Plummer would be the only shot for an Oscar nomination, I think, in supporting. But the film goes on way too long, Doug. It's a little confusing to follow as to why, who's involved, why did this group kidnap him, what's their aim here outside of money? Is it a political aim? Is it not? So the film gets a little confusing that way, but I do think it's worth a look as kind of an old-fashioned espionage thriller. But it just runs out of gas, then it's too long.
Well, I've read a little bit about Ridley Scott making this decision to replace Kevin Spacey, and it was a very important decision to make because there's a lot of money riding on a film like this. But it also reminds us of how films are made, because you could bring in an actor a long time after the fact and simply replace that person.
Yeah, and Wahlberg and Williams were available to come back to reshoot scenes with Plummer that they had shot with Spacey. Ridley Scott is famously known for working fast, Doug. He is kind of the Steven Soderbergh of older directors. He's 80 years old. He's in phenomenal health. The man cranks out a film a year, and he said, I can get this done. I can reshoot this. We can edit every night. It's not like the old days, Doug, where they had to edit film together and view dailies and rushes. Mm-hmm. It's much different now with digital and the way film is edited now, and he did it. I don't know that it's a great film. It's a solid little film, but it's just too long. But Plummer actually, I think, helps the film. I don't know if it's going to be worth all the money they spent on the film. Not all the money in the world, but they did spend some money on the reshoots. But Plummer's very good, and maybe he can eke out a supporting actor nomination. I'm not sure, although he did not get a SAG. But again, things happen so late in the game here that maybe there will be some support for Plummer.
Well, these are two movies I want to see,
okay.
The Disaster Artist and All the Money in the World. Well, here is our Oscar trivia question for this week, and I would call this the bedrock Oscar trivia question.
Okay.
How did the Oscar name come about?
So I think it is based on Betty Davis's first husband, Oscar. Is that correct, Doug?
Well, the story
the statue looked like her ex-husband's butt. Is that what she said?
No, this is Margaret Herrick.
Okay.
As the story goes, worked as a librarian at the Academy, and upon first seeing the statuette, commented that the statuette looked like her uncle, Oscar.
Okay. I've heard several different stories on that, so I'm not sure which one's true. We'll go with that one.
Well, yours sounds pretty good, too.
That's what Betty Davis said years later, but I don't know.
Well, she said a lot of clever things.
Yes, she did.
We've been to the movies with Matt Holine.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 5th. On January 6th, 1919, Thorstein Thorsen took over the Dunn County State's attorney post. A man of high principles and morality, Thorsen was a statesman and a politician. He was also a fine orator, becoming a colorful figure in North Dakota politics. Born in December 1885 in Norway, Thorsen immigrated to Minnesota with his parents and attended St. Olaf Academy at Northfield, graduating in 1909. In 1910, he moved to Dunn County, bought a quarter section of land, farmed, and taught school. He entered the University of North Dakota Law School in the fall of 1911, graduating in 1916. While in Grand Forks, he married Inga Medine Vegan in 1912, and in between stints at UND, helped on his brother's farm near Dalton. Thorsen eventually established a law office in Dunn Center, where he became active in social and community life. He was also interested in politics, especially the Nonpartisan League. In 1918, he ran for state's attorney and took office in January 6th of 1919. One of Thorsen's first acts was to uphold prohibition. He also dealt with gambling, trespassing, illegal cohabitation, farm foreclosures, school attendance, and filed suits against the railroad. After two terms as state's attorney, Thorsen moved on to state politics. His first statewide campaign was for attorney general on the NPL ticket in 1924. Though defeated, Governor Arthur Sorley appointed him as tax commissioner. Thorsen gained tremendous statewide support as tax commissioner, so he decided to run for governor. He lost the June 1928 primary to George Schaefer. Thorsen was again appointed as tax commissioner in 1927. However, when Governor Sorley died in 1928, Thorsen decided that the new governor, George Schaefer, should be able to appoint his own tax commissioner. Thorsen resigned and opened a law office in Bismarck, later moving to Grand Forks in 1930. He continued his political involvement, running against William Langer for the NPL endorsement for governor in 1932. When Langer was convicted of conspiracy to violate federal election laws in June of 1934, Thorsen supported Thomas Moody's gubernatorial run against Lydia Langer. Moody's victory was short-lived, and Lieutenant Governor Walter Welford became the fourth North Dakota governor in 7 months. Thorsen spent 2 years in Minnesota, then returned to North Dakota, where he served in both elected and appointed positions until his death on April 16, 1956, ending over 40 years in North Dakota politics. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Kathy Langamo. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Monday on Main Street, Into the Amazon is a new television documentary about Theodore Roosevelt's harrowing expedition down a tributary of the Amazon River. And on Monday, North Dakota humanities scholar Clay Jenkinson will join us to talk about his involvement with this documentary. And how about a three-day-long snowmobile race? Two-time winner Brian Nelson will tell us about the upcoming International 500, a race from Winnipeg to Bemidji, Minnesota. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.